Ladies and gentlemen, as a connoisseur of ironies, I particularly relish this occasion, for an historian whom nobody knows has been called upon to introduce an historian and philosopher whom everybody knows. And rather than try to find some persuasive reason why I should have been accorded the honor of introducing our distinguished John Dans professor, let me simply accept the privilege and pleasure of welcoming him to our campus on the occasion of the first of his series of three lectures, which have been made possible by the vision and the generosity of Mr. and Mrs. John Dans. In this winter of our budgetary discontent, when many of our programs may have to be reduced, we have the more reason to be grateful to Mr. John Dans and his wife, Jessie Dans, who 10 years ago made a major gift to the University of Washington and established the fund, the John Dans Fund, which is of lasting value to the University of Washington and to the larger community. Relevance has become the slogan and sometimes the battle cry of the student generation. And perhaps no one in academe today is more sensitive to the meaning of relevance than the historian. In my own undergraduate days, it was a question that was seldom, if ever, raised. And we young historians were content to accept the integrity of history and its value as a humane study without question as to its utility or relevance. Indeed, many of my contemporaries were in a very real sense fundamentalists for whom history was revealed truth, flowing from documents which might be subjected to searching philological or textual criticism, but whose content once established fixed the account of history as it actually was. If an occasional question arose, we were rather like the two Jesuits about whom Ranke tells us, who were sent to convert Christina of Sweden. Those two great experts in theology found the problems raised by the Queen so stimulating that as they reported to the Home Office, thoughts occurred to them during the talks which they had never thought before and which they promptly forgot afterwards. Our speaker, Sir Isaiah Berlin, was one of that courageous band of scholars who raised fundamental and disturbing questions about the nature of history and who, by shaking our faith and certainty, made us more sophisticated in our approach to the study of history. In reviewing his inaugural lecture, Two Concepts of Liberty, given at Oxford in 1959, the Times Literary Supplement noted, "Professor Sir Isaiah Berlin owes his large and Catholic reputation, which extends beyond academic circles, to the fact that he so obviously dissents from the narrow, constricting belief that academic gifts and qualities are only properly expended in the pursuit of academic issues. He takes as his natural province issues that are of universal contemporary interest. The facts of Sir Isaiah Berlin's distinguished career have been set forth in the program, and I shall not repeat them here in extenso. He comes to us from Oxford University, with which he has been associated during his academic career, and where he is today professor of social and political theory and president of Wolfson College. He is the recipient of many honors and holds honorary degrees from universities in Britain and the United States. Of his many books, I single out for your special attention his Karl Marx, his Life and Environment, The Age of Enlightenment, Historical Inevitability, History and Theory, and perhaps his most widely known book, The Hedgehog and the Fox, which deals with Tolstoy's philosophy of history in War and Peace, but touches also upon the moral problem as well as upon the problem of the meaning of history. In history, as a leader in the Times Literary Supplement remarked a few years ago, careful scholarship is not everything, and the final assessment must be judgment upon the historian as thinker, a measurement of imaginative power. These are the qualities that Professor Berlin has brought to us in his books and will demonstrate in this series of John Dan's lectures. Careful scholarship, yes, but even more than that, profound thought and in full measure imaginative power, which enables him and us to recognize the relations of value to fact. It is a high honor to present Sir Isaiah Berlin to this audience in the first of his three John Dan's lectures on the assault on the French Enlightenment. And this evening's lecture is entitled Herder and Historical Criticism. I assure Sir Isaiah that we are honored by his presence and we're grateful to him for joining the other distinguished scholars whose presence on our campus has been made possible by the generosity and the vision of Mr. and Mrs. John Dans. Sir Isaiah.
Ladies and gentlemen, I must begin by thanking Professor Katz for his very kind, overkind introduction of me, and only hope that I shall live up to about half his expectations. Even that would satisfy me. I ought to apologize, and I wish to express my gratitude to this university and to the founders of this series for doing me the honor of inviting me. I ought to make several apologies. The first is for the fact that there are one or two misprints in the text of the titles of the lectures which are entirely due to my poor handwriting. But if my handwriting is poor, it is as nothing to my general audibility, which is even worse. May I explain to you that for reasons which I cannot control, for causes which I cannot control, I tend to talk rather rapidly in a low voice. And it's possible that some people here, particularly those sitting in the back, will not be able to hear what I say. Now, I should beg them, if they in fact cannot hear and wish to hear, on that assumption only, that they should do something to indicate some degree of mild discomfort by some mildly unconventional means, by waving their hands or, or stamping their feet or doing something to attract my attention. I shall then endeavor to go more slowly and talk more loudly. I don't promise to succeed, but at least I'll try. I say these things on the assumption that people at the back can hear what I say, because if they can't, it's somewhat, self-stultifying. And now, if I may begin, I must start with the second apology, which is, I realize that this series of lectures is really dedicated, and very properly, to celebrating the achievements of the Enlightenment. Now, I certainly don't come to criticize it, or indeed to say anything derogatory about it. I regard myself as a friend of the Enlightenment. Nevertheless, my subject is that of an assault upon the Enlightenment. That is to say, upon certain harsh critics of it, who it seems to me have made a tremendous difference to the way in which we think, and who have, if they have not actually destroyed Enlightenment, at any rate left it in a somewhat damaged form. I think perhaps the friends of Enlightenment can learn more than they would from mere praises of the Enlightenment, can learn a great deal from its enemies. There's nobody so illuminating as people who attack and who show up weaknesses in a movement which, on the whole, one wishes to support. That is my reason, at any rate, for accepting your kind invitation. Let me explain, by way of introduction, that the movement about which I intend to talk seems to me to be of crucial importance. I hate to use the word relevance, but I'm afraid it is in place. Of crucial importance to the history of ideas in the last century and in this one. It's one of those big shifts of opinion which seems to me to have affected both thought and action. In fact, I should like to defend the position, and if anyone wants to attack it after the lecture, I shall be interested to hear. I'd like to defend the proposition that it's the biggest single shift in what might be called general intellectual thought, or general thought about many subjects, that has occurred until the present day, including Marx, including Freud, and anything else you please. I should like to maintain also that this enormous change occurred in the second third of the 18th century, principally in Germany. Let me explain what I mean. There are certain thinkers who are men of genius and show it by answering questions which have been asked before in a manner which is more satisfactory. Let us say Newton or Archimedes answered questions, let us say in mathematics or in physics, which had indeed been asked, to which nobody had given so brilliant and so powerful, influential an answer before. That, however, is rather different from thinkers who don't simply answer questions which already exist, but thinkers who somehow transform the perspective in which questions are asked. They don't so much answer the question as alter the nature of the question itself, shift the entire context and perspective in which the questions are asked, in such a way that questions of an earlier age are made to seem irrelevant or obsolete. Such shifts have occurred not very frequently in human history. If you want examples, I dare say when, for example, perhaps when Pythagoras appeared in the scene, and mathematics was for the first time applied to the external world, this must have made an enormous difference in outlook to people who had previously been brought up in some Homeric world picture in which things were due to chance or the intervention of individual divinities. Something of the sort must have occurred, perhaps, when, let us say, the notion of creation was introduced. Let me tell you, when the Jews and the Christians introduced the notion of creation out of nothing by God, this was something which genuinely was alien to the then classical world. There's no notion, no real notion of creation among the Greeks. Even the demiurge in Plato's Timaeus, who creates a world, creates it according to a plan, which is from eternity, which he doesn't himself invent. The idea of inventing something absolutely new and creating something out of nothing, the whole notion of creativity, obviously burst like a bombshell in a certain sense upon the then classical world and produced a definite shift of consciousness. Every category, every concept was somewhat affected by it. The same can be said, for example, in the 17th century when the notion of teleology was succeeded by that of mechanism. A man who lives in a world in which everything has a purpose, every stone, every plant, every human institution is in some ways striving towards fulfilling itself, towards realizing some inbuilt goal, and therefore who can explain everything in terms, say, of instruments or an orchestra, all of which are playing according to some preconceived plan, preconceived either by a personal God or by an impersonal nature. A man who lives in a world like that, in which everything strives to complete itself, strives to fulfill some kind of inner purpose, is quite different from the man for whom there are just things lying about, just one event after another, which stones are stones, plants are plants, with no particular purposes. The only purposes there are the purposes which men have given to things. Clocks have purposes because men have made them for a purpose. Stones have no purposes because they just are brute facts, created by nobody and nothing, and simply lying about, whose behavior, whose, for example, laws of behavior, what is next door to what is later than what is simultaneous than what, it is the business of the sciences to establish. These things really do create a total change of categories and perspective. And it is with a change of this magnitude that I intend to deal in these three lectures. Let me continue by saying that I propose to grossly to oversimplify the issue, otherwise I don't think I can place it before you, even in three lectures. Let me begin with a generalization. I think it wouldn't be altogether false to say, I won't go further than that, it won't be wholly misleading to say that the central doctrine of what might be called Western thought, from the Greeks onwards, rests on three legs. It's a kind of tripod resting on three legs, or it can be somehow reduced, as I say, by gross oversimplification, to three propositions. The first proposition is that to all real questions there must be at least one true answer. A question is not a question unless there is an answer. If there is no one true answer, one and only true answer, all the other answers being false. If there's no true answer, then the question is not a question. This has been asserted by positivists nowadays, but it is certainly as old as Plato. The assumption is that to every question, whether a fact or whether a value, there must somewhere reside an answer, whether we know it or not. The second proposition is that questions of value, how we should live, what we should do, what is right, what is wrong, questions in, say, moral philosophy, about whether, I don't know, honor is to be preferred to love, whether patriotism is to be preferred to friendship, or whatever it may be. Serious questions in morals, like serious questions in politics, why should we obey anyone, in fact? Why should we obey kings, governments, parliaments, majorities, minorities, elites, specialists, whatever it may be? Questions of this type are, like questions of fact, capable of one true answer which must be discoverable somewhere. The only problem is to find the correct method, and the correct method must exist, otherwise a question is not a real question, but merely a set of words with a question mark after them, hiding some kind of confusion. The third proposition is that all the answers to these questions, all the true answers, must be compatible. They may, in fact, involve each other, but they must be compatible because one true proposition can't be logically incompatible with any other true proposition. These are very important propositions, all these three, but particularly the last one, because on the assumption that all these answers are compatible rests the proposition that you could formulate, in however general terms, some kind of notion of a perfect world, of a perfect form of life, which simply was the realization in practice of all the true answers put together like bits of a jigsaw puzzle. And that, I think, underlies what might be called the whole of the central tradition of Western philosophy, whether Christian or pagan, whether rationalist or mystical. There are, of course, vast differences. The differences occur, for example, of where you ought to look for the answer, how you ought to find it. Some say the answer is to be found in sacred books. Others, in, let us say, the revelation given to prophets or priests or holy men or mystics. Others say, on the contrary, in some metaphysical insight given only to philosophers after a special period of training. Others think, not philosophers but scientists, the answer lies in laboratory, in observation, in experiment. Or there are people who say that the answer is that of majorities, that democracies know the answer, or on the contrary, minorities, some kind of group of qualified experts, some elite. Some say the Pope, some say shamans, some say not there either, but perhaps in the breast of a simple, pure man, as Rousseau thought, in some innocent child's mind, or that of some untutored savage, not corrupted by the hideous sophistication of our cities, and so forth. People differ about who has the answer. But everyone agrees that the answer must be capable of being found somewhere. Again, who is the authority? Is it majorities or minorities? Is it a specialist? Or is it any man with common sense? Or perhaps we can't discover the answer at all. Perhaps we're too sinful. Perhaps we're too stupid. Perhaps we're too lazy. Perhaps we're not, our minds are not powerful enough. Well then, there are people who say the answer was known once upon a time in the Garden of Eden. And after that, after the man's fall, the answer disappeared. Others place the golden age in the future. We don't know now, but one day we shall be omniscient, if we progress far enough. Or people may say, we shall never discover the answer. We're too feeble, or we're too corrupt. Or perhaps people will say, men do not know the answer in this life, they will know it in the next. Or men do not know it, but angels do. Angels don't know it, then at least God does. Somebody must be capable of knowing the answer. Unless the answer is in principle knowable to somebody, the question isn't the real question. That, I think, is the underlying assumption of the entire Western affair. That is really what underlies the great doctrine of virtue is knowledge. Virtue is knowledge is not a self-evident proposition. Why should the virtuous also be knowledgeable? Well, but the answer is quite plain. If, in fact, we have certain desires, we have certain inclinations, we have a certain kind of nature which strives for whatever it does strive, then the only way in which we can satisfy it is by understanding ourselves and understanding the world and understanding our relation to it. Only if we understand will we go for the correct goal. All error, all vice, all crime is founded upon this misunderstanding either the means or the ends. If a man knows that twice two is four, he doesn't think it's five and a half. If a man knows that what will make him happy is this rather than that, is one kind of existence, say a rational life, rather than an irrational one, then, according to this doctrine, he couldn't possibly go for an irrational life knowing that it will make him miserable. The whole doctrine from Plato onwards, roughly speaking, says, unless you understand reality and understand yourself, you will not be able to discover how to live or how to fulfill those purposes which in fact you have. If you make a mistake, if you misunderstand reality, if you think, for example, that crime pays, or that it is possible to do it by ignorance or indolence or something else, then by God, reality will get you in the end. I mean, that is the threat which is uttered by all the rationalist philosophers throughout history. And therefore, virtue is knowledge simply means it's impossible both to know how to get what you want and not to proceed to go for it. If you do that, if you know that means X will lead to the end Y which you want and don't adopt means X, there must be something lunatic about you. You must in some way be irrational, so to speak. To take the wrong road to a goal to which you know the right road, if it is your goal, is not something which a sane human being does. Hence, virtue, that is to say, what makes you wise, happy, good, free, all the other blessings, this is a matter of knowing. And the people, therefore, who are admired during this period are those who know, sages, people who get things right, successful persons, successful in some lofty sense, but still successful, whether soldiers who conquer territories or profound philosophers who understand the truth. But the admiration always goes to him who is successful, him who knows, the sage. All this alters greatly. Of course, bloody wars have been fought about who is right and who is wrong between Muslims and Christians or Protestants and Catholics, because, after all, everything depends upon it. If salvation depends upon the correct route to the secret treasure, then nothing is too dear to be sacrificed for it. And that is why it's quite natural there should be fearful struggles. But what both sides accepted is, there is a road. The question is, am I right, is he right, are we both wrong? But there is a road, there must be a road. Otherwise, so to speak, what are we doing? How can we even ask the question? And in particular, during the period of which I speak, of course, in the 17th century and the beginning of the 18th, the enormous success of the physical sciences, the vast triumphs of Galileo and Newton, dazzled, and quite naturally dazzled, the minds of a great many intelligent persons. If Newton was able, with a very few simple propositions, to produce a doctrine from which, or produce a set of truths, from which you could deduce the position and movement of every particle of matter, and in this way stopped a lot of wild medieval speculation in astronomy and physics, which had no empirical and no scientific basis, then, by God, why can this not be applied to those regions where obscurity and confusion and chaos still exist, namely the regions of values, ethics, politics, and the like? Here, too, by applying rigidly the methods which are so triumphant in the realm of nature, we shall be able to clear up this scandalous mess, these hundreds of answers which have been given throughout history, none of them able to prove themselves, none of them able to be demonstrated. But once we apply this great machine, here too, the Augean stables will be cleansed, and at last we shall discover what the ends of man are, what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong, what the proper way of government is, what the right life to be lived by a rational, sane human being must be. That is certainly the hope of the 18th century, influenced, as I say, by the great success of physics. How is this to be done? Well, certainly the French encyclopedists thought it must be done by education and by legislation. Why has mankind suffered for so long? Why all this vice, this misery, this suffering, and this frustration? A favorite view, particularly propagated by Voltaire, for example, was that this was due to a great many knaves who took in a great many fools, roughly speaking. And the whole thing is a kind of conspiracy. There are always groups of people grasping after power, who throw dust in people's eyes and teach them all kinds of nonsense in order simply to retain power in their hands. Sometimes individuals, sometimes classes, sometimes whole countries. If you can expose these charlatans, if you can show them up for what they are, then at last a new age for mankind might dawn. And this can be done by establishing proper principles of research. Public, intersubjective, capable of being checked by any intelligent man coming to the problem, not a cult confined to the breasts of a special set of persons, special set of beings, lamas or priests, whoever it might be, who simply claim monopoly of these things, the better to enslave the rest and make them do the will of the dominant majority, the kings, the conquerors, the generals, the priests, who are regarded simply as malefactors, persons who've simply enslaved mankind for their own advantage. This is, again, a very simplified view. But this is certainly the kind of indignation which I think broke out in the 18th century against this vast accumulation of religious and metaphysical nonsense, as was thought, which had beclouded the eyes of men and which prevented them from attaining to the truth. Well then, this new rational method must now be applied. And therefore, ultimately, legislation must be introduced to eliminate the cheats and the charlatans and put in lucid-minded, honest scientists in charge. Education is not enough because people might not be willing to be educated in that way. Tradition is too strong. The prejudices die too hard. There's too great a vested interest on the part of all kinds of corrupt groups. Something stronger is needed. Example and precept are not enough. Mankind has had enough of them, said Helvetius. We need something stronger. We need laws. We need something which will stop people from propagating nonsense and planting misery where health might be, and regarding disease as a normal condition of mankind, particularly spiritual disease. We must stop monks, let us say, from flagellating themselves because they cause pain to themselves. The fact that it's they who cause pain to themselves, no matter. Anyone who multiplies pain in the world is a criminal. Therefore, monks, priests, and the like should be incarcerated. Whether they can cause pain to other people or themselves makes no difference. We are engaged in multiplying, we're engaged in increasing human happiness. Men have no right to be miserable. And anyone who makes himself miserable, quite apart from his neighbors, is not serving the best interests of mankind. This was the extreme position of what might be called the most rationalist encyclopedists in the middle of the 18th century. Mind you, the view that all questions are ultimately technical, which is what this comes to, that the ends are given by nature, that if you study men, you will discover what men truly want. You will study them by means of sociology, you will study them by means of psychology, you will propagate mathematics, you will propagate chemistry and physics, all the rational sciences will be established on a sound basis. Once you've discovered what men are like, and what they need, and what will make them free and wise and good and happy, the next problem is to provide them with it. And with enough technology, enough wisdom, enough disinterestedness, enough, so to speak, public spirit, by God, this can be done. All problems ultimately are technical problems, because the ends are given. They are given in exactly the same way as they are given to animals or to stones. You know what a bee wants, you know what a beaver wants, by observing them. Entomologists know, zoologists know. What we need is a zoology of human nature. We need scientists who attend to human beings exactly as these other scientists attend to creatures in nature. That is the program of Condorcet, for example. There always were, I must warn you, certain persons who cast a certain amount of doubt upon this entire program. Even in ancient Greece, there were persons called sophists who said, according to Aristotle, or one of them at least said, why is it that fire burns both here and in Persia, but political and moral customs change under our very eyes? There were other persons later on, certainly at various libertins, various skeptics in France in the 16th and 17th century, who echoed these sentiments. Montesquieu pointed out that things which are good for Parisians are not necessarily good for Persians. That climate makes a difference, geography makes a difference, tradition makes a difference, people's tastes vary, people's needs vary, people's habits vary. It is no use wearing fur coats in southern Arabia, no use wearing Arab garments in the snows of St. Petersburg. The idea that there must be some universal answer to all the questions, there must be some propositions, as it were, which will answer everybody's questions everywhere, quod ubique, quod semper, quod ab omnibus. Universal answers true of all men at all times in all places cannot be quite right. Because men differ, because circumstances differ, all this is a truism now. But even Montesquieu, let me say, even though he said these things, and he said something much more sinister, he said, when Montezuma said to Cortes, your religion, i.e. the Christian religion, may be all very well for Spaniards, but the Aztec religion suits my people best. What he said, says Montesquieu, was not absurd. When Montesquieu said that, he was fallen upon by both sides. Obviously by the Christians, by the Roman Church, if the truths of Christianity are true, then obviously Montezuma's subjects believed in a lot of soul-destroying nonsense. Equally, the encyclopedists and the atheists believed that if what Christianity preached was false, it was a mistaken thing to say it was all right for the Spaniards, and equally wrong to say that the religion of Aztecs would suit Montezuma subjects. Either it's true or it's false. The idea that something which is true here may be false there, or something which is true here may be useful there, something which is useless here may be useful there, struck both sides as a remark of a corrosive and destructive cynicism. But even Montesquieu, even the skeptical, doubting man, who for the first time really spelt out the notion that different things are believed in different places, the whole now familiar notion of relativity, of value, even he wasn't really as subversive as all that. All it really comes to is that different means are used in different circumstances. Even he didn't deny that all men wanted peace rather than war, warmth rather than cold, food rather than starvation, sexual procreation rather than total celibacy, and the like. They all needed something or other, but the means towards it in the Russian steppes are different from the hills of Greece. The means towards it in Iceland are different from those in Peru. But, in other words, and that's why customs vary, but the goals of men are not all that different. Even Hume, who is regarded as having blown up a great many of the presuppositions of the Enlightenment by pointing out, say, that values are not logically connected with facts, and facts not logically connected with logical statements. Even Hume simply translated statements of value which were regarded as metaphysical and in some way binding on everyone into semi-sociological statements of what people preferred or what people approved. He simply translated the truths of metaphysics into those of psychology. But even he would say that a scientist could discover what various people did approve of and how far they could be given it and how far a compromise could be struck, but what A wanted and B wanted. In short, even he supposed that science would be useful, indeed the most useful of all things, by simply discovering what it was that men felt like, what the subjective desires of men were, how they were to be satisfied. He didn't differ all that much from the program of even the most rigorous encyclopedists. The people I intend to talk about were a great deal more subversive than that. They blew up, or tried to blow up, the entire affair, all the three propositions, and after them, all I can say is, they never looked the same. Now, let me begin by giving you a sort of preview, in a sense, of the kind of situation which I think these men were responsible for. And by these men, I mean Kant, Herder Kant, and Fichte in particular, and to some extent also the poet and dramatist Schiller, who was a very faithful disciple of Kant and a very competent philosopher. In the middle of the 18th century, people still believed that what was wanted was wisdom. What was wanted was knowledge. What was wanted was success in human endeavors, achievement. And they admired the great men, whether of thought or of action, who had managed to get what they wanted or managed anyhow to answer the most agonizing questions of mankind. Supposing, however, you had wandered through, say, German universities round about 1810, let's just take that year in the 19th century, you would have discovered that this was not at all the ideal of the average romantically inclined student of the place. They didn't care for success. They were not interested in learning, at least when I say they. I mean that famous dominant minority which sets the tone. 80%, so to speak, normally speaking, go in the steps of their fathers. But there are always 20 who are in some way upsetting, as so to speak, as no one here needs repeating. These 20%, these subversive, so to speak, revolutionary-minded persons, both among students and among the teachers, believed by this time that what was wanted was not knowledge, not skills, not clarity of thought, not security, not a happy family life, not pleasure, above all not happiness. These things they despised. They believed in defiance of conventions. They believed in originality of temperament. They believed in martyrdom. They believed in fighting against established values at whatever cost. They thought that failure was nobler than success, which was ultimately vulgar. They thought that defiance showed a greater degree of moral strength and moral passion than mere succumbing to what might be called the ordinary conventional wisdom of the generation. They admired the bold opponents of the regime, even the satanic, rather sinister heroes of the Gothic novels or of Byron's works. Above all, however, they prized sincerity, they prized integrity, they prized dedication to an ideal. Consider, for example, the meaning of the word idealism, not in the philosophical sense, but in the ordinary sense. This is not a word which is used much before the 19th century. Idealism means that you admire people who are prepared to sacrifice life, riches, success, career, to serving some kind of ideal which they truly, truly believe in. What the ideal is comparatively irrelevant. The point is they're prepared to die for it. The dying is more important than the correctness of the ideal itself. The martyrdom is more important than the validity of the thing for which the martyrs are martyrs. Now, martyrdom was always prized by Christians, but that was because you died for the truth. You were not, if you died for a falsehood, it was merely pathetic, not heroic. If you take, for example, the Crusades, take Christians and Muslims. You won't find in these great battles between Christians and Muslims, you won't find a Christian saying about a Muslim, it is true that what he believes is damnable heresy. It is true that what he believes is terrible nonsense, but one has to hand it to him. He believes with utter sincerity, he believes utter integrity. The heroism and the splendor of the quality of his belief transcends the fact that I happen to think the content of this belief to be inaccurate and not to lead to salvation. On the contrary, people who really believe with passion, people who really believe with total self-surrender to these abominable truths are all the more dangerous and therefore deserve to die all the more necessarily because they are far more likely to poison society. No Catholic in the 17th century congratulated a Protestant upon the sincerity and purity of his beliefs. The purer the belief, the more dangerous, the more mad. You wouldn't, I mean, if you were a gentleman, you didn't spit on your enemy's grave. But that's about all it came to. But you certainly didn't congratulate him on the intensity, on the, as I say, dedication, on the marvelous sincerity with which you held on to your ridiculous or dangerous views. By the 19th century, this was not so. By the 19th century, there begins to be a worship of sincerity and integrity as such. If I think one thing very strongly and you believe the exact opposite, we fight a duel, in the course of which I may kill you, or you may kill me, or we may kill each other. But any of these things are preferable to the one intolerable solution, which is that we should compromise, that we shouldn't kill each other at all, because that means that you've betrayed the inner light within you. You've decided, for the sake of the miserable desire to continue to be, to sacrifice that for the sake of which you are living. You've extinguished the light within you. The hero of the Romantic generation of the 1820s, for example, is some man, let us say, like Beethoven, who sits in a garret, who is personally dirty, unkempt, rude, and ignorant, but he serves the inner ideal with passion, integrity, and absolute devotion. It's all the better, no doubt, that his music happens to be music of genius. But even if it weren't, he would still be admirable for the absolute devotion, passion, and purity of heart with which he serves the flame within him. Haydn and Mozart would have been extremely astonished to be told that there were sacred vessels who in some way testified to some deep inner vision which they had to bind upon the souls of mankind. They were simply craftsmen working, producing objects which they hoped the public would find beautiful. If a great many public members of the public found it beautiful, they would earn a great deal of money, if not, not. But they were simply purveyors who did their best, and if they were geniuses, the objects were marvelous. But they certainly didn't see themselves, as artists did in the 19th century, as specially selected sacred beings, so to speak, with a kind of mandate to suffer, to be agonized, not to, so to speak, above all, not to sell out. The great sin, so to speak, was selling out. The great sin was adapting ourselves, conforming. This is the particular movement which, of course, has come to rich fruition in our own day. But and its consequences, I think I shall try and examine later. But that is the contrast with what these people believed. Take, for example, Balzac's story, which is called The Unknown Masterpiece, Le Chef d'œuvre Inconnu. You have a painter there who is mad and who keeps on painting, putting more and more colors onto his easel, until the picture, which began by being a picture, becomes an absolute chaos of unrelated daubs, bits of color and so on, not intelligible to anyone at all. Well, this is not a masterpiece, and the painter will not be famous, but it's preferable that a man should do this, even though he may be rather off his mind, even though he may be rather mad, than that he should produce picture postcards for commercial purposes. Because that is obviously selling out to society, selling to the market, betraying the light within you, no longer being authentic, no longer doing your thing. Doing your thing is the heart of the Romantic doctrine of the early 19th century. And it is in sharp contrast to the most advanced and luminous and rational thought of the mid-18th. And something happened in between, which of course leads to all kinds of political consequences. Nationalism comes from it. Extreme heroic individualism comes from it. Anarchism comes from it. The cult of violence, the cult of eccentricity comes from it. Elements in fascism come from it. Elements of existentialism, all these things which are so contemporary now, so to speak, spring from this particular mood. And it is the thing which has set its seal upon the individual and the public life of our time from the mid-19th century onwards, never more than today. It is really with the rise of this and how the paradigm of what might be called the Enlightenment, particularly in the 18th century, came, if not to be broken, at any rate to be severely damaged, that I wish to deal. Now, the One of the persons who I think is most responsible for this is the German historical philosopher Gottfried Herder. Herder was born in East Prussia. He was a poor boy and suffered all his life from a peculiar hatred of what might be called the smarter culture of the French West. Let me say something about Germany at this point. Naturally, ideas are not parthenogenetic. The ideas don't breed ideas in vacuum. They have some connection with the lives that men lead, economic lives, social lives, however you wish to interpret them. And they arise in some way, not necessarily as a result of, but at any rate as factors in a larger world which does not consist simply of ideas in the heads of intellectual persons, but of the lives of the society into which they are born. In some way, there are causes, but there are also symptoms. And they are heavily bound up with the social history of their time. It doesn't necessarily, it's not Marx alone who has taught us this truth, but he certainly emphasized it. There is something peculiar about the whole German position, I think, since the Renaissance. There is a certain sense, I think, in which Germany can really not be said to have had a proper Renaissance in the normal sense of the word. If you traveled across Europe in, say, 1500, I think you would have found that German art, German culture was no whit inferior, was of the same sort as the countries through which you passed. The culture of Burgundy, the culture of France, the culture of Italy, the culture of other countries. If you did exactly the same thing in 1600, I think you would have found Germany to be somewhat provincial in character. The age of Dürer, the age of Grünewald, the age of Reuchlin had passed. If I ask you to mention a single great German name, which is contributed to something to human culture between, say, 1570 and 1670, just take that bit, before the 30 Years' War, to which this is usually attributed, I think it's very difficult to find someone. There was Kepler, no doubt, who was a kind of eccentric astrologer near Munich. There was Althusius, who was a respectable thinker, but not exactly of the front rank. There are names, one can use names. If I ask you what your views are about Uden and Moscherosch, I wouldn't expect you to give me the answer immediately. These are persons who occur in respectable histories of German literature. Claudius is quite a good poet. There are German names. They're not uncivilized by no means. The general level of education is very high. But there are no outstanding persons, and if you compare what might be called the cultural contribution of Germany during this period, apart from Lutheran theology, to that of France, which is going through one of its most brilliant periods, to that of Italy, even during the late Renaissance, to that of Holland, about which I needn't speak, but the rise of both science and painting on an unexampled scale, to that of England, even to that of Sweden at that particular period, you will find that Germany is something of a backwater. And the feeling that somehow they are inferior, somehow the real things are going on elsewhere, that it's really in Paris, it's really in Venice, it's really in London, it's really in Amsterdam that real progress is made, that people are excited, that new truths are being discovered, that money is being made, that pictures are being painted, that life is being lived in some intenser fashion, that a larger, richer culture is developing. This begins to oppress the Germans at quite an early phase. Until Leibniz, the rise of Leibniz, and the thinkers and musicians, say, of the 18th century, Germany feels herself in an inferior position vis-à-vis the West. And this leads, quite naturally, to a profound degree of sense of humiliation, particularly vis-à-vis the French. Particularly vis-à-vis the French who are the top of the world, who are militarily and scientifically and culturally and linguistically and in every possible respect a kind of cultural top nation. And look with infinite contempt upon these provincial clodhoppers, these beer drinkers and pipe smokers in Germany, who at best produce clergymen and grammarians of an unimportant kind. This is the attitude towards the Germans, certainly, round about 1630, 1640, during the period of the 30 Years' War, quite apart from the massacres which were going on in that particular period. And this includes portions of the empire. It includes Vienna as well. Apart from architects, it's very difficult to think of any first-rate personalities. When this kind of thing happens, and in particular when political impotence is very strong, as it was in Germany where there are 300 principalities and all these petty tyrants, and total subjection, encouraged by the Lutheran Church to the temporal authority, the natural reaction to this is a retreat into oneself. Since one can't have the fruits which the world offers, one begins to teach oneself not to desire them. The Stoics, at the time of the collapse of the city-state, were precisely in this frame of mind. A kind of, I don't say escapism, but a kind of retreat in depth into a kind of inner citadel begins. I am poor. The only way in which I can console myself being poor is by saying riches are unimportant. The tyrant oppresses me. Very well, liberty, political liberty, it doesn't matter. The tyrant is going to destroy my house. Houses are of no importance. The tyrant is going to kill my family. Personal ties are not the most important thing in the world. What then is important? My inner soul is important. That which nobody can take away from me. A kind of contraction occurs. People try and contract the vulnerable area. They try and preserve that at which nobody can get. This is before the age of, so to speak, psychological penetration. Before the age when people began to brainwash other people. And when you really thought that your inner life was somehow protected from the behavior of your enemies, of the tyrant, of people who oppressed you, whether foreigners or people in your own part of your own nation. And so you get, as with the Stoics, you get a kind of protection of the inner citadel. If you like, the idea is, if I can't have something, I must teach myself not to want it. If I can't have what I want, I must teach myself to want only what I can have. And if it's very little, then I contract myself into the smallest possible space. My inner life nobody can take away. My music nobody can take away. My thoughts nobody can take away. Anything which needs money, anything which needs political liberty, anything which needs grandeur, anything which needs power, I can't do. Very well then, these things are dross, are nothing. My religion teaches me to despise these things. If I can't have them, they are, I refuse even to consider them. I make myself free of them by not being tied to them. A kind of Buddhist process begins of trying to detach myself from things which otherwise might enslave me. This is particularly strong in the most derelict and the most abandoned part of Germany, the poorest and the most, so to speak, old-fashioned, East Prussia, where the culture of the West has hardly penetrated by the beginning of the end of the 17th century. It's only beginning to do that. And it's there that you will find two of my thinkers, namely Kant and Herder, both East Prussians, both one in Königsberg, the other ultimately traveled to the West, but began his life, at any rate, in East Prussia, in Königsberg too, or near it, rather, in Moravian, in Prussia. These are the people, so to speak, who in some sense feel themselves most part of a most abandoned society where desire for material goods, so to speak, has been artificially suppressed by an intensive inner process of attending only to the spiritual life. That's what the Pietist movement, in a sense, was about. Intense self-preoccupation, belief only in personal values, your conscience and your direct relationship to God, away with priests, away with magnificence, away with pomp, away with ritual, all these things are for the rich and the grand and somewhere else. Away with art, away with political power, away with large forms of social expression. A kind of glorified provincialism, in a sense. East Prussia was a place to which Frederick the Great had brought his French officials in order to put it in order. And the humiliation of having to face these French officials with their obstinate French language and their extreme contempt for these primitive Prussians, so to speak, is one of the causes of the extreme resentment of Parisian values which the thinkers of whom I am about to speak had. These are the circumstances in which Herder grew. He started as a literary critic. That's to say, he started as a critic of language and of literature. And it's from that that his whole doctrine begins to develop. The doctrines of the French Enlightenment were, of course, that there were certain truths in aesthetics as in everything else. Even Montesquieu, who is such a relativist in politics, when he goes around the museums of Italy, knows very well which pictures are good, which pictures are bad, because there are certain rules, but which we apply quite mechanically to them. These rules are eternal, universal, and easily learned. So Joshua Reynolds, when he delivers his lectures in London, is quite clear that there is a thing called the great style. The great style means that there are certain original prototypes of all artistic experience which every painter should seek to reproduce. For example, he says, if you should wish to paint King David, it may be that in life David was a mean little fellow with a hare lip. Nevertheless, if you are to paint him, you must paint him as a royal personage. A royal personage is not small, is not mean, and does not have a hare lip. And therefore you must paint David as a king, and the notion of a king is something eternal. There is a universal prototype of what it means to be a king. There's a universal prototype of what it is to be a sea, a river, a house. This is the great style. You do your best to copy these great Platonic originals, these great immutable originals which, like mathematical figures, are untouched by change and time. If you have a special eye, that is, if you have genius, you have learned the laws of perspective, you understand the rules of art, then you will try and reproduce these things in some medium or other. Above all, and this is the theory of mimesis, of imitation, above all, don't copy directly from nature. Nature may not come up to expectation. Nature may not reveal what is really behind nature, which is a magnificent series of perfect examples of that which you wish to paint, upon which your true eye should be directed. And what is a work of art? A work of art is something which is beautiful, and which those who have an eye to see will recognize to be beautiful, because it will obey the laws which make things beautiful. The rules which are just as universal, just as objective, just as open to any man at any time, in any place, as the rules of ethics, the rules of politics, the rules of chemistry, the rules of physics, or the rules of anything, whatever. That, in a certain sense, is an 18th century doctrine. The same applies to poetry. Augustan verse is preferable to the rough hexameters of some early pre-Virgilian poet. We know that. There is progress in the arts. They were crude and primitive. We are civilized and nearer perfection. The ideal is the same for everyone. Some are further from it, some are nearer. History may not be in a straight line. There may be moments of progress and moments of retrogression, but the ideal towards which men with sense, with eyes to see, are tending is one and the same. This is the proposition which Herder found quite intolerable, and he found it so for this reason. To the critics of the 18th century, a work of art is simply what it is. The intentions and the motives of the artist are, on the whole, irrelevant. You want a painting, I will produce it, I, the painter. What my private opinions are, why I produce it, is perfectly irrelevant to you. You want a table, I'm a carpenter, I produce a table. You have no business to ask me if I'm a pious Christian, if I'm a good father, if I'm a respectable citizen, or what I was doing yesterday morning. This has nothing to do with it. You want a table, here it is. What you admire is the object. The man who produced it is not relevant to the object. The object itself is what is admired. It, so to speak, lives in its own incandescence. The biography of the man or his intentions are not relevant to what it may be. And that is the theory of a work of art as an object independent of the creator. That is the theory of a scientific theory as something independent of its inventor. It's a general theory of the fact that things are what they are and can be judged to be what they are, can be evaluated as they are, in terms of certain unaltering relevant rules. For Herder, this was a terrible blasphemy. Art for him, and he was the first person to say it in fully, and this was quite a revolutionary moment, art for him is above all a voice speaking. It's communication between one human being and another. It's not the production of an object, it's not the thing. It's not producing something which lives in its own light. Art is simply a function of the total personality of a man. As a man speaks, a man walks, a man eats, a man drinks, he worships, he takes a journey, he creates works of art, he dances, he sings. All these are expressions of the total human personality, which you can't divide up into this I do qua artist and this I do qua father. If a man says, as an artist I say this, but as a citizen I say that, he's lying. Because in some way, he's what's now called role-playing. man is one and undivided. Art is a natural human activity as walking and eating and worshipping and any other human activity must be. It's simply the fullness of feeling which bursts forth and which you wish to put into some concrete shape. Early art is meant to inspire lovers or hunters or soldiers or fathers of families. It's not a golden box. It's not simply a golden box or a silver statuette to be admired by Conrad III. This is a much later development. Art originally is a form of self-expression, in other words. And if it's a form of self-expression, then it is a form of the total personality seeking to be understood by other personalities. Now, this seeking to be understood means that the only way in which I can understand a work of art is by understanding what the man is trying to do. When I hear a man use words, the first thing which I ask myself is, what is he saying? What does he mean? And I understand what he means by his face, by his gestures, by the kind of man he is, by the kind of clothes he wears, by what I know about his past. The more I know about him, the more fully I realize what it is he's trying to say to me. The same is true of a man who paints a picture, a man who dances a dance, or a man who tries to worship his God. It's a total expression of a human being which can only be understood by other human beings by coming into the process of some kind of acquaintanceship with him. The same applies to the art of the past. If I'm to read Homer, I can really only understand Homer if I understand what it was like to be an early Greek of his period. If I wish to understand the Bible, says Herder, and he was particularly interested in Hebrew, of course, because he was a Hebrew scholar, among other things, then I must not look at it as a timeless document, which means exactly the same to every generation, in every country, in every clime. This is the religious outpouring of primitive Judaic shepherds. And if I can get to the mountains of Judea, and if I can somehow translate myself into the primitive life of these Judaic shepherds, these words will have quite a different meaning from me, from what they will have if they are translated into our own sophisticated language, from which the quality and the flavor and the intention very likely evaporates. That's why all translations, in a sense, are bad. Someone once said, poetry is what is lost in translation. Herder would have applauded the sentiment, because what he wanted was some kind of direct communication between human beings. He tells us that on his journey from Riga, on the Baltic coast to Nantes, to which he went through a fearful storm off the Swedish coast. Only then does he say did he understand when he saw these grim sailors battling with the waves and the iron discipline which they had to display and the fearful odds they were against. Only then did he begin to understand the language of the early Scandinavian skulls, of the Eddas, of various types of Nordic epic, which was conceived in and could only be understood in relation to the particular kind of grim and brutal nature which these men were forced to encounter. So that Herder is the first person who, so to speak, for the first time, articulates a theory that art is expression. It's not the creation of objects. It's a form of communication and creation. Creation and communication are the same for him. This is true of every province of human activity, whether it is by dance or by words or whatever it may be. The second idea, and therefore, the Parisians must be wrong. They must be wrong. It isn't the case that there are certain universal static rules in terms of which human products can be judged. The art of the skulls must be understood from what the point of view of the skulls, what they were trying to do. The Bible must be understood from the point of view of these shepherds in the mountains. Homer must be understood from the point of view of the Greeks of his generation. Aeschylus can only be understood by someone who understands about ancient Greece, about Athens, and therefore studies not only the literature of Athens, but all its institutions, its geography, its history, its laws, whatever he can find fragments of its habits. In other words, he is one of the earliest thinkers to conceive of something called a culture, where every element reflects and reacts against all the other elements. And where from any given bit, you should be able, by a species of imaginative sympathy, whatever you would like to call it, empathy, Einfühlung, he calls it, feeling yourself into the object, you should be able to reproduce the whole. Not by logical means, not by induction, not by the scientific means recommended by the French, but by some species of feeling akin to that with which you understand the thoughts of a friend, with which you understand an expression upon a human face. Herder begins to explain what symbolism is. Symbolism is what cannot be expressed by words. The waving of a flag, the singing of an anthem, the particular kind of bold and defiant clothes which you may wear in order to shock your neighborhood. As the German students were liable to do in the 1780s when they danced around liberty trees and grew special beards in order to shock the rather shaven, bewigged conventional persons by whom they were taught. This kind of thing is something which can't be conveyed in words at all, because if you ask yourself, what does a Gothic cathedral actually say? You can't say what it says, but it certainly conveys. It certainly stands as an emblem or symbol of an attitude to life which is quite different from that of the ancient Greeks or that of the ancient Arabians. The emotion which you feel when a particular kind of symbol is waved at you, a flag, a handwriting, anything you wish, is something unique. And this reaction towards something unique is wholly different from what other people in some different position would react to in some under different circumstances. What do the French understand about this? For Herder, these scientists, these encyclopedists, these illuminated persons were simply a mass, some of them at least, some he respected, but a great many were simply a mass of superficial, dry little abbés in salons, superficial, brilliant, witty, amusing, but who did not understand the depth of the human soul, that which really made men tick, so to speak. Whereas the Germans, oppressed, miserable, poor, despised, lower class as he himself was, they, partly because of their tragic condition, were driven in on themselves, and they understood what it was that made men men. That, I think, is the original sermon. And therefore, the first attack is upon the notion of the universality of values, and above all, of the applicability of rules. The second concept, which I think we owe to Herder also, is the concept of belonging. He was the first person who really explained in vivid language what it is to belong to a group. He said, among basic human needs is not only that for food and for drink and for liberty of thought, which he recognized, and for procreation and for whatever the other basic human needs are, and for shelter and for protection, there is also a basic need to be amongst your own. If you ask yourself, what is a German? It's difficult to say it in words. It's certainly nothing to do merely with living upon a certain soil or owing allegiance to the same king or in serving the same army. There is a way in which Germans eat, drink, pass legislation, sit down, get up, do their hair, write poetry, dance. All these various activities, although they resemble the activities of other people who also do these things, have something in common which is impalpable, unanalyzable, and German in character. The way in which the Portuguese eat and drink and dance, and the way in which they produce their laws, the way in which they study their history, the way they look, the way they get up and sit down, the way in which, the kind of moral and political beliefs which they hold, these things have more in common with each other, so to speak. That's to say, the way in which the Portuguese do their hair is more like the way in which the Portuguese speak, or the way in which Portuguese move or think or feel, than they have with the corresponding behavior on the part of the Germans. There's something in common, no doubt, to the way in which a Portuguese and a German eats, or the way in which a Portuguese and a German walks. But there is something which is also not common. And if you take a German away from a society in which people communicate with him, not merely by explicit words, but by facial expressions, by the thousands impalpable and imprescriptible and unanalyzable gestures and methods by which people can understand each other. If you take a German out of this milieu and put him among the Portuguese, he will feel a stranger. He will feel an outcast. He will feel an outsider. He will feel a misfit. And this sense of being a misfit is basic, and people want to avoid it. And that is why the Germans want to be Germans, the Portuguese want to be Portuguese, why Icelanders who come to Denmark do not flourish, why the Hessian soldiers who were sent to the United States wither away, why people cannot live a satisfactory life outside the particular milieu to which they're used. And this is what he calls to belong. It has nothing to do with what is normally called race. It has certainly nothing to do with blood. But it has a great deal to do with language. Language to him is one of the intimate links which bind people, because people are brought up in a language and are past their traditions, their feelings, the whole sense of what they are and where they are and who their friends are and who their enemies are is conveyed by the nuances of a language which is not translatable into any other language or any other medium. Hence the importance of the German language for the preservation of what might be called the German outlook. And the idea is that there is a German outlook and there is a Portuguese outlook and there is a Chinese outlook. And these things are different. And to say that there are common values to them, that what some wiseacre in Paris invents, say, a theory of life, that democracy is best, or monarchy is best, or enlightened despotism is best, or anarchy is best. That these things, because they've been proved by some syllogistic method, or by some other logical method, will equally suit a Portuguese and a Chinese, is untrue. Not only for the reasons given by Montesquieu, because their environment is different, their climate, their geography is different, but because they are themselves different and they cling together. There is such a thing as to belong, and there is such a thing as to be an outsider. And the most valuable of all pains, he says, the most sacred of all pains, is homesickness, nostalgia. That is a very feeling native to men. Now, he doesn't, of course, think about states. He's against the state, because the state is a great cold monster, as Nietzsche called it. It suppresses these little local communities to a large extent. It's an artificial political entity. The real entity is some kind of neighborhood. The real entity is a group of people using the same language, brought up in the same culture, holding similar beliefs, who feel at home and cozy with each other. Now, this notion of belonging and the desire to belong and the fact that people who don't belong don't feel well is something which is native to Herder. He really did, in a certain sense, invent that. And because he invented that, he denounced the cosmopolitanism, the internationalism of the French tradition. He says, on the whole, that a savage in his hut who loves his wife, who loves his children, is much more likely to understand the feelings of a stranger and be nice to him, whereas in the empty heart of the cosmopolitan, there is no home for anybody. This is roughly the kind of, and this is, of course, the beginning of a certain kind of nationalism. Now, in latter day, of course, it fed all kinds of chauvinist and nationalist fires, gradually evolved into the most hideous forms of pathological nationalism in the 19th century. But in Herder's case, it was perfectly amiable. He thought of it entirely as a local affair, something which groups of human beings, not very large groups either, have in common. Perhaps people who speak the same language, perhaps the people who have lived in the same soil together, perhaps people who are related to each other or have some kind of common ideas. And he did not believe in immigration, because once you immigrate, you will lose something infinitely valuable. Assimilation always robs you of something. What he hates most of all are conquerors, assimilators. It doesn't matter what kind. Julius Caesar is a villain because he crushed the Cappadocians, and we shall now never know what they really wanted to tell us. We shall never know what the Carthaginians even had to tell us because Rome snuffed them out. Charlemagne is a villain. Louis XIV is a villain. All these great conquerors are villains. Even the British missionaries in India are villains. Because although what they do in the interest of religion, they suppress native Indian customs. They assimilate the Indians. They remove their native color. They impose all kinds of foreign dresses, foreign customs, foreign habits upon them. And in this way, the native, unique, unanalyzable, impalpable, deep Indianness of the Indians evaporates. Now, for a Christian clergyman, which is what Herder theoretically was, he was head of the church in Weimar, for a Christian clergyman to complain that the trouble about missionaries is they planted Christianity, which is an un-Indian religion, was really going quite far. But he did go that way. Just as he complains about Klopstock's great German poem, The Messiah, which is, after all, celebrates the central value and the central event of the entire Christian outlook, he complains that it's not German enough. This is Herder. And the important thing, though, so to speak, is the notion that people can only be understood in their own context, in their own time, by some kind of direct communication. Therefore, the universality of what might be called the traditional position cannot be true. It isn't true that the same values obtain. He goes on from there to the point that every nation has its own center of gravity. That's where its happiness lies. The Greeks were happy in one way and the Romans in another. Germans are in the Middle Ages are happy in one way and now in another. It's no good going back. To try and be Greek is absurd. To say return to Aristotle is ridiculous. Aristotle was a great thinker, but he was a Greek. Whereas Leibniz is ours. Homer is a great writer, and one could, with enormous effort, enter the clothes of the primitive Greeks, but he's theirs. Only Shakespeare is ours. You must understand your own time, and you must try and be as authentic as you can. Do that which the spirit impels you to do. Don't go whoring after either something in the past or something far away. If you do that, if you simply express yourself, write, act, be a politician in some native fashion, then maybe posterity will recognize you as a classic. Otherwise, you certainly have no chance. Above all, use your own means. If you're a German, speak German. If you're a Frenchman, speak French. His nationalism is of an extremely tolerant and harmonious kind, somewhat like the Russian populists in the 19th century who didn't overstress the importance of being a Russian. Russian critics of the late 19th century with a populist bent adored every phenomenon which is regarded as quaint, unique, its own. They liked the Finns to be Finns, they adored Georgians to be Georgians, they studied Jewish antiquities, they studied Mongol antiquities with loving care. And Herder is really the father, not at all, of exclusive nationalism. For him there is no favorite nation. There are no good nations and bad nations, or important nations, unimportant nations, or top nations, bottom nations. Everyone, in a sense, is equal. He is really the father, in a sense, of the whole school of ethnic study, both ridiculous and serious. Both serious ethnology, serious understanding of foreign peoples, sympathetic understanding of customs not at all our own, on the one hand, and all those old ladies and all those antiquarians who want the natives to be quaint, who want the natives to preserve their own customs, who hate the thought of Coca-Cola being introduced into some native village. In a sense, Herder's the father of all that. He's the father of what might be called a loose desire for variety, for quaintness, for national color, for uniqueness, for differences. Above all, no assimilation, no flatness, no uniformity. Let me explain to you that the desire for multiformity is a late desire. The whole of antiquity wouldn't have understood you if you had said that monotony was bad. For antiquity, broadly speaking, one is good and many is bad, roughly. But by the time you get to the 18th century, that is to say, by the time you get this enormous monopolistic attitude of the French Enlightenment, and a kind of, in a sense, a kind of crushing superiority in the matters of politics, of ethics, of art, and of everything else, on the part of the mandarins of Paris, you get a longing on the part of the humiliated Germans for variety, for their own, for uniqueness, for doing things in their own way, and that is where all that is born. One more thing and I shall cease. There is one large implication in what Herder says, which is of crucial importance to what I said. If you remember, one of the propositions I uttered was that according to the Enlightenment, there's only one true answer to each question. And all these true answers are compatible with one another. Therefore, if we say, what is perfection? Perfection is the putting together of all the true answers into one jigsaw puzzle. And then we know what the perfect life would be. Maybe we can't attain to it, because we're too weak, or because it's utopian. But at least we know what perfection is, otherwise, what do we mean by saying we're imperfect? When we say we're imperfect, we mean there is a falling short from this ideal of perfection. But if we don't know what perfection is even, what is the point of saying there is progress, there is a goal, we're imperfect, we haven't got there yet, where is there? Now, if Herder is right, there's something wrong with this. Each nation, each group, each Volksseele, or Nationalseele, as he calls it, the national soul, the popular spirit, he invented the word nationalism, I may say, although he was not a nationalist. Nationalismus, for Herder, meant the peculiar qualities of a particular human group, living on a particular soil and using a common language, and having kinship amongst themselves. For Herder, if it was marvelous for the Greeks to be Greek, and for the Hebrews to be Hebrews, although the Hebrews are quite different from the Greeks. It's wonderful for the Indians to be Indians, and for the Georgians to be Georgians, and for the Russians to be Russians, all of which he thought. And a great crime to try and lump them together, assimilate them, get some lowest common denominator, and try and assimilate them all and get them all into the same basket, if that is so. Then what is the point of talking about perfection? These ideals are not compatible with each other. To be a successful ancient Hebrew is to have values quite different from a successful ancient Greek. There is no marriage between Aristotle and the prophet Amos. None. There is no marriage between the ideal of the Arminius in the German woods in Roman times and between some German bourgeois in Jena. There is nothing common to the Gallo-Romans of the 4th century and some physicist or chemist or mathematician in Paris in 1770. And yet, each is perfectly entitled to strive after his own ideal, because every group has its own center of gravity within it, because the happiness of the Hebrews is attained by quite a different way from the happiness of the Swedes, because each strives towards its own ideal, and one is not superior to the other. No period is an anteroom to another period. Voltaire is, for him, utterly wrong when he thinks, for example, of, say, the Middle Ages as a peculiarly horrible corridor to the Renaissance. Herder didn't care for the Middle Ages because they were too fanatical, because they were too anti-scientific in a way, because they were too repressive, because they were too blind. Nevertheless, the Middle Ages had its charms, had its values, its outlook, which is different than the Renaissance. The Greeks are not a step toward the Romans. The Hebrews are not a step toward the Christians. The Italian Renaissance is not a step towards Louis XIV or anything else. Each of these things has its own intrinsic value. It's like the late professor, Mr. Wyndham Lewis, who once wrote a book called On the Demon of Progress in the Arts. It isn't true that the later, the more developed. It's no good saying that Roman painting must be superior to Greek sculpture because it's later, or medieval cathedrals must represent some advance upon Greek sculpture, or that Picasso must represent some advance upon Michelangelo. It doesn't make sense. Each of these artistic expressions, which is what Herder was mainly thinking about, has its own intrinsic value, not comparable to, not commensurable with the rest. But if this is so, I can't be both a perfect Hebrew and a perfect Greek. I can't be a perfect Frenchman and a perfect German. How are we to create a universe, according to the encyclopedists, as Condorcet would say, by finding out what men want, by giving them what they want? Because all men have fundamentally the same nature, they all have the same wants, they all have the same strivings, they only think they don't because of the false doctrines propagated among them by a lot of lying priests or a lot of self-interested rulers. If this is so, then the very ideal of the perfect life is an absurdity. It's an absurdity because the perfect life of the ancient Greek, whether you believe it, would be wholly incompatible with the perfect life of the ancient Hebrew or of the modern Italian. Because Aristotle is not ours, but theirs. Because Shakespeare is ours and Homer is theirs. And it's no use saying which is superior, which should we follow. We mustn't follow anything. We must simply do our thing. We must express ourselves as well as we can in the terms we have. That is Herder's doctrine. And in this sense, he's the father of three things. Of art as communication, and not as the making of silver boxes. Of art as not having a set of rules, but of being direct expression of human beings seeking to convey not everything about themselves, and therefore their social selves, their society, the whole accumulation of tradition which lives in them, the whole accumulation, so to speak, of the human values of their interrelationship with others, which every one of their gestures in some sense encapsulates and conveys. Secondly, he understands what is meant by saying to belong to, and men cannot belong to more than one group at once. They belong to where they belong, and that is alone what can realize all their hidden potentialities. It's not irrelevant to a man with whom he associates. He must be among friends. He must be among people with whom there is an instinctive bond and not an artificial bond. All immigrants suffer to some degree. And thirdly, there is this notion, as I say, of each group has its own center of gravity, its own purpose, its own ideal. And these ideals are neither commensurable with each other, still less combinable. And therefore the very notion of the perfect man, the perfect society, the perfect sage is unintelligible. This is something quite different from saying, as people have said, we shall never attain perfection because we haven't got the means, because original sin, because we're not perfect. Or saying, as Rousseau and others have said, every gain entails some loss, you can't have everything. It doesn't mean you can't have everything, but the idea of putting these things together produces contradictions, because they're not compatible with each other. All this Herder set in circulation. He himself, of course, believed in the garden of many flowers, all of which lived in peace with each other. So far as he was a nationalist, he was a pericultural nationalist. He hated all forms of authority. He thought the state was a jackboot, which crushed human originality. He loathed armies. He loathed wars. He loathed assimilation. He loathed every form of interference. But from these doctrines that I belong to my people, and I convey their point of view, not somebody else's, they did, of course, bring the seeds of nationalism, which whether in the romantic form of Michelet and Mazzini, or in the far more brutal form of the chauvinism of the early German nationalists, say people like Jahn and Arendt, and ultimately, so to speak, in what developed into all kinds of pathological nationalist and fascist doctrines, this really, so to speak, it can be attributed, so to speak, to the seeds so innocently planted by Herder. That is the first attack upon the universality and the cosmopolitanism and the, in a sense, the what he regarded as a dehumanizing, depersonalizing, excessively abstract, excessively general tendency of French thinkers who didn't understand what it was to wish to express the inner life, because they had no inner life, because they were entirely absorbed in what he regarded as superficial, external facts, capable of scientific generalization. Anything which is genuine, anything which is human, anything which is really means something to either an individual or a group, cannot be conveyed in general propositions which equally apply to groups or individuals who have grown up in a different atmosphere, speak in a different language, and wish to convey a very different set of values. Next time, I propose to talk about a very different approach by the philosopher Kant and his pupil Schiller, and I ought to add that Kant regarded Herder's views with undisguised contempt and was paid in exactly the same coin by Herder. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Isaiah, for that brilliant lecture. May I remind you that the second lecture in the series will be given in this auditorium at 8 o'clock on Wednesday, and the third, same time, same place, on Thursday. Sir Isaiah has agreed to stay for a few minutes, not to answer questions from the general audience, but if any of you have a question to ask, just cluster around the front of the auditorium, and he'll be very pleased to speak with you. Thank you.